And this talk is supposed to be quite philosophical. I'm going to focus on the choices that leads to this this formalism. I think in due course you will know why this approach is called world quantum gravity. So something I will touch on, are which might you might be interested in, are at which step does indefinite causal structure enter quantum gravity? I plan to tell you that at a very early step. And then, why single out causal structure in studying quantum gravity? And if you want to construct a theory of quantum gravity yourself, what kind of factors do you want to consider this construction? And this talk is going to be like discussing the choices. There are five choices I made that lead to this world quantum gravity approach. The first choice is to focus on gravity. This means we work with some gravitational degrees of freedom, G, to start with. This G isn't the metric. This is any physical variable that describes gravitational degrees of freedom. And this is not the only way to proceed. There are some alternatives. For example, people considered having emergent gravity emerge in different ways, like entanglement from thermodynamics, holography, matter degrees of freedom, agent operations, spin chains, etc. And these alternative approaches and this more traditional approach to start with the gravitational degree of freedom are not necessarily distinct, because we can take G as whatever that expresses gravity. If you take an emergent gravity approach, some of these, for example. For instance, if you want your gravitational degree of freedom to emerge from operational agent operations, you want to consider their signaling strength, then you have some measure for their signaling strength, and then you want to recover gravitational degrees of freedom from this operational approach, then I will take G as the signaling strength, because this is the variable that describes the gravitational degrees of freedom. So in the end, you have this G. And then the choice I made is just that I work with this G to consider laws and regulations and patterns of gravity. And choice two is to use the path integral approach. Here I'm considering not the traditional, you know, functional integral approach, but a more broad kind of understanding of path integral. So you have an amplitude, probability amplitude for some physical process happening on quantum spacetime. As an example, consider the QFT of GR. Here you have a matter part, it's on a fixed spacetime G, which you sum over all the matter degrees of freedom M. That gives you a matter amplitude on this spacetime. And then you introduce another factor of quantum gravity, and then sum over gravitational degrees of freedom. For example, in QFT of GR, the matter part, you have this quantum field theory on curves on some background spacetime. That's the matter action here. After that, you introduce a Einstein-Hilbert action for gravity, and then you do a path integral for gravity. So here, it's just a generalization of this scheme. And in fact, this path integral approach is quite popular in the hardcore quantum gravity community. These approaches that you're familiar with, they all use path integral. Metric approaches, quantum Ricci calculus, causal dynamical triangulation, variant LQG, spin foam, this is loop quantum gravity, causal set, etc. Basically, you choose different variables, G for the gravitational degree of freedom, you arrive at different approaches. And your task is to specify this gravitational amplitude function according to the variable you chose. And less popular are covariant approaches, for example, canonical loop quantum gravity, and others. There are other approaches. For example, suppose that we don't, the underlying theory is classical. We have a Bohmian type description of gravity as well. So there's no really fundamentally you have a classical theory. Quantum gravity emerges in some approximation. And here comes an important point. Where does indefinite causal structure enter into quantum gravity? I think generically, it enters already when you choose the path integral as your approach. Consider, for example, classical space-time with a boundary. There are two events, x and y. You have these three causal relations, or. And then when you introduce a path integral, you have these two events on the boundary, you're summing over all the different gravitational configurations inside of the box, summing over these amplitudes. Now, in some G configurations, x is in the path of y, and in another, some other configurations, it's the other way around, and in other configurations, they're not causally related. Now, you're summing over all these configurations. So in this sense, you're having a linear sum, a linear superposition of different causal structures. This is quite generic. It doesn't depend on which variable you choose for G. Now you have a definite causal structure. But then people don't discuss quantum indefinite causal structure much in these traditional approaches to quantum gravity with path integral. Why? I think there's this milk flavor ice cream question. When you go to an ice cream shop, you don't ask for a milk flavored ice cream. You ask for a lemon flavored, not milk flavored because ice cream is made of cream and cream is milk flavored. So if every approach has indefinite causal structure, why would you single it out for study? This is a question I raise, and I plan to address it in the end of the talk to keep some in suspense. The third choice is about basic variable. So which variable do you use for G? So here are some examples from relative approaches. These approaches, these traditional approaches of quantum gravity. But the metric approaches is symmetric. Quantum Regi calculus, it's the invariant length and deficit angle for dynamical triangulations. It's number of simplices or covariant loop quantum gravity, stage variables and the algebra variables. Causal set is a number of elements and their causal order. So there are lots of choices. And how do you make a choice? How do I make a choice? Here are some factors I think are important to consider. It's not difficult to write down a theory of quantum gravity. We have all of these different proposals. Difficulties come from trying to do quantitative analysis. When we actually calculate things for quantum gravity, we're dealing with many body systems or field systems. And quantitative analysis, if you think about it, is not easy. For example, for matter QFT, we already have to resort to approximation schemes like perturbation theories. And then for strong coupling systems, it's even now, after many decades of understanding of QFT, it's still less well understood. So you need to worry about the practicality of your approach. After you write down a theory of quantum gravity, how do you analyze it quantitatively? And it's important because we hope to make some predictions, quantitative prediction. Also, it's not easy to identify useful observables in quantum gravity. It's a non-issue. What kind of predictions do you make after you've written down your theory? And there are some subtleties for including matter degrees of freedom into your theory, because if you use a particle, then there's some subtleties with relativistic causality. If you use the field, then there's some subtleties for your quantum gravity side, if you use, say, a lattice, it's not easy to put a field theory on the lattice. There are subtleties. And finally, you have to consider your signature of space-time. Euclidean signature is unrealistic because we live in a Lorentzian space-time, but practical. It's easy to do quantitative analysis for Euclidean signature theory. But then Lorentzian is realistic, but hard. For example, it's hard to do Monte Carlo simulation if you're in, you have complex numbers. But these are, I think, after you've written down your theory, these are things you need to worry about. And this choice I made is had some considerations. It is partially motivated by these difficulties. So I choose the world function as the basic variable g. The world function is quite a simple quantity. Take this standard presentation of the metric. So you have a geodesic distance squared as your definition of the metric. And then now the metric is defined on every point on your spacetime. But its meaning, its physical meaning, is that it gives you spacetime distance. Now, the world function simply takes this meaning seriously. Instead of considering the field at every point, you consider the distance integral of this quantity for pairs of points. Singe considered this, I think, in the 50s or 60s, and he called it the world function, I suppose, because if you know this distance for every pair of points, you know the whole world configuration for the gravity.
Is it taken along some path?
It's taken along the geodesic. So for why it's taken along a geodesic.
So it has to be a time-like
path? No, it could be space-like, light-like, it could be anything. The geodesic does not have to be time-like. And the good thing about this function is that it contains all the information of the metric. So use through this formula. So if you worry that if you choose this as a variable, you may miss something from the metric. You don't have to worry about this because everything is contained in sigma. And why do I choose sigma? It's because of these considerations on the previous slide. I'm just copying down the 4 points here with the green text. First of all, it's a practical quantity. It's a scalar. It's invariant. You change a coordinate system to the prime system, the value of sigma stays the same. And that helps quantitative analysis. You don't have to deal with some gauge degrees of freedom. And second of all, it's matter friendly. You can, in fact, I'll show later on that for your matter amplitude, you can also express it in terms of sigma. So you're unifying matter and gravity degrees of freedom in sigma. And that helps in identifying useful observables and helps, of course, in including matter. If you have matter, you have more choices of observables. For example, you can consider what's the implication of quantum gravity on particle colliders or the early universe particle creation. And third of all, it makes the causal structure manifest. Sigma through its sign tells you the causal structure. If sigma is zero, you have light-like separation. Is greater or less than zero, it's time-like or space-like separation. Yes.
How do you know the geodesic in a quantum world?
I will put things on a lattice. That's the question next. I will not use the manifold. And I suppose on the lattice, on the edges, these are geodesic distances.
If you make the lattice spacing exceptionally tiny compared to the fluctuations in the gravitational fields, it's not clear that there's a well-defined geodesic even on lattice.
Uh-huh. So in a sense, I'm giving up the notion of geodesic. I just say there are.
But then how do you calculate the world function?
It's some variable you propose. You postulate that they're there. There's some real numbers.
So it's classically equal to the world function, but it's.
But quantumly, yes. Just like for.
I was gonna leave it to the end. Is there some issue in taking these derivatives in terms of covariance, perhaps? Like, what's x, what's y? Like, how do I?
Very good question. I will not use this formula.
Okay.
I will not use this because, of course, in principle, you can plug this formula for every g that appears, for every metric that appears. And in the end, it's not going to be practical. Well, at least as far as I can see, it's not going to be practical. So I will use another magic,
okay.
Parker's magic, to use
okay.
to avoid using these derivatives. Good questions. So next, I want to locate the sigmas, not on a manifold, but on a skeleton. Basically, I have a graph. For concreteness, you can think of this as a 4D lattice graph. And I'm drawing it for 2D, but just use your imagination to promote it to 4D. Now, for every edge, you assign some sigma. These J's and K's, they label the different edges. For every edge, there's a sigma. And this is a discrete structure. And it's supposed to approximate the exact result for the amplitude for quantum gravity. So you can do fine graining. You can increase the number of edges and vertices to improve your calculation, this approximation. And one thing to stress is that I consider this as an algorithmic discreteness, not necessarily fundamental. Think of just standard path integral for a non-relativistic particle. How do you do the evaluation? You discretize time into steps with integral epsilon, and you do the calculation, and then you take the limit of epsilon going to zero. But this is a kind of algorithmic discreteness. You want to calculate, you want to evaluate the path integral. This is part of the algorithm. But it certainly doesn't assume that time is fundamentally discrete. Similar thing is happening here. I'm using a discrete lattice, but that's part of the algorithm. I'm not assuming that space-time is fundamentally discrete.
And
that
parentheses or is it Lorentzian or Euclidean?
It's Lorentzian. So, because
so you can have sigmas being very small, but very
that's right. That's on a particular coordinate system, they can be probably separate. Yes, it's Lorentzian approach. So you may ask now, if the discrete structure is not fundamental, then why would you use a discrete structure? Why a skeleton? The reason is I think it's quite deep. Relates to engaged theories. Because sigma is a relational and local quantity. So think of a manifold. Suppose we want to try to find sigma on a manifold. Let's see what happens. Let's see what stopped us from using this. On a manifold, consider pairs of points, so x and y prime, this pair of points, on a geodesic, and in the middle, you take another point, y. And because of this definition of sigma, you have this equality. So the larger distance is the sum of the smaller distances. First of all, this quantity sigma is relational because it's defined for pairs of points. Second of all, it's local in this sense. The global value originates from sum over local contributions. This is an important property for the distance. Now let's try to do, say, a path integral on a manifold. And let's see what stop us from using this. On a manifold, you do a path integral for the metric. You're actually taking a product of different points on the manifold. Then doing an integral for this metric, for this tensor field, at every point. Let's do something similar for sigma. For every pair of points, x and y on the manifold, have a sigma, and you're taking a product of all these pairs of points. Then sigma is a real value, so the path integral, you take an integral over these real values. And what's wrong with this? this loses this information, this the sense of locality, because you wouldn't know that the distance between x and y prime is the sum of these smaller distances when you do this path integral. You're just doing integral for pairs of points, and they don't know these pairs of points. They don't know the topology of the manifold. That's why we use a lattice. Then, if you assign these sigmas to these lattice edges, they know which they know the topology of the manifold, of the space time. And this this is a similar move in as in lattice gauge theory. We start with a gauge field that's locally defined. We then change to a relational quantity of the Wilson line defined for pairs of points. And this is actually an integral, which means this is a relational and a local quantity. And then we can do lattice gauge theory using this prescription. Now, fourth choice is about the gravitational amplitude. So that's take a summary of what we have so far. The first choice is we focused on gravitational degrees of freedom, and then we chose path integral to this formula. With the third choice, we fixed G to be sigma, the world function. Now we have this formula. The next two tasks are to specify AQG in terms of sigma as the task we are considering, and later on we'll consider specifying AM, the matter amplitude. So what's our strategy? Our strategy is to start with the standard Einstein-Hilbert action and change it into some expression in terms of sigma in three steps. First, I'll introduce triangle as a measure of curvature. This is a function of sigma. Next, I'll use a trick discovered by Parker in the 70s. Which is pretty magical. It could relate the amplitude from Einstein-Hilbert action to delta, to triangle. And in the final step, I will write this gravitational amplitude in terms of delta sigma. So sigma is a measure of curvature. It has this as a definition. Delta is a measure of curvature. And here in this definition, C is a constant. It's determined by some boundary condition. And theta is the expansion parameter. So the picture to have in mind is this one. So imagine in the origin, you shoot out some light rays in all directions. And you want to measure the curvature of space-time through the density of the light rays on a sphere, on the surface of a sphere. On flat space-time, the density would be this term. So S is the geodesic distance coming from the world function. So it's just basically the inverse of the area of your sphere. But then if you introduce space-time curvature, you will have some expansions due to curvature on your light ray geodesics. This will change the density of light rays on the sphere, and this is measured by this quantity of expansion parameter. This is the same thing that shows up in Richard Urey equations, if you're familiar with it. And it can be re-expressed in terms of the second order derivative of the world function. And S, which is also expressed in terms of the world function. So this whole thing, theta, is a function of the world function.
So sigma AA is dx A dy A traced over A, is that the idea?
That's right. And then, yes.
Why isn't that just, so it's not a delta, I mean, it would be one or the number of dimensions or something, wouldn't it, in general?
It's a finite, this is a...
some non-trivial limit, I guess.
This is a fight for finite separation. So it's not, you're not taking limit of x going to y.
So why is
no.
the theta a function of x and y?
Yeah.
Because, okay, so you're doing this integral, so you're considering x here and y is on the boundary. Then,
in the boundary is
and then, oh, so, sorry, so in this case, it's y is at the origin, x is at the boundary. You're measuring the expansion of this this congruence of geodesics originating from the origin. You're measuring it at the boundary. So it depends on where you start.
That's right. So, but I still would think that it would be that it should have a y variable in theta. It depends where you start.
It's there. At least.
Right. It's implicitly, it's there.
And doesn't delta then also depend on x and y? Because you're integrating over s, you're not integrating over
yes.
x.
Yes, it depends on, yes, it's, you can think of this as a part of the Wilson loop.
Okay.
And actually, there's this analogy with the Wilson line. So look at this expression, it's similar to this one. And delta in the literature is known as the Wernicke-Moret determinant. It's been discovered many decades ago, used widely. Okay, the second step is to use Parker's magic, which basically says you can, under a path integral, so imagine you have a path integral from y to x, somehow over different paths, under a path integral, you can change this term into this term freely. So in a sense, you eliminate r in favor of sigma in terms of the triangle. And C is an arbitrary constant. That's what's magical about it. So you can basically have a feeling of where this is going. You start with something, Einstein-Hilbert action here, and you change it into delta. And this slide is a bit dense. It'll take five steps to arrive at the final expression. You start in the first step with the infinitesimal Einstein-Hilbert action. Consider these colors are helpful in understanding this proposal. This is your infinitesimal Einstein-Hilbert action. This is the volume part with a coupling constant. So on this 2D lattice, you consider this as the area as your volume. So this pink part is associated to this part. And there's this volume factor. There's this curvature. So these are attached to the edges labeled by J. This if the color is too light, so this is a J's edge here. And in a second step, you just assign this basically to the edge. And in fact, you can show that this volume factor can be expressed in terms of the triangle. And also here you have a four volume, and here you have the distance on the edge, Sj, and the other three dimensions come from the neighboring edges. You're calculating basically the volume of here and volume of here, and then taking an average. So this is what what alpha does. So in a sense, you're focusing on an edge and then calculating the volume for every neighboring elementary volume. And the next step, you want to make use of these constants. So you want to make use of Parker's trick here to make the transition. Here there's a C here, there's an L here. So basically you specify C to be this quantity here and L to be this quantity S here. That allows you to make the transition, to get rid of R in favor of the triangle. And in the next step, later on, we will combine with matter to obtain gravitational amplitude in terms of sigma alone, without referring to the metric. So for the matter amplitude, basic strategy is start with ordinary Feynman diagram and use localized Feynman diagrams using the world line formalism. and then put things on the skeleton. This is just an ordinary Feynman diagram you're familiar with. So not right into the details. You can find the details. This is just a standard textbook Feynman diagram, OKLT with matter. And the new thing is you use the world line formalism to localize these topological Feynman diagrams. Feynman diagrams are topological in the sense that these curves, wherever you draw it on the manifold, it doesn't matter because it's just the propagator. It only depends on where you start and where you end. But you can re-express this Feynman propagator in terms of path integrals where the path location does matter. This is a known trick since many years ago. Nowadays, people study this trick systematically in the world line formalism. So now you have gamma as correlation diagrams where the location of the curves matter. And just summing over different gammas, gamma 1, gamma 2, because you're doing path integral. And this is just to say that even though I'm considering only a scalar field, this is more than a scalar field because all the space-time dependence of matter is encoded in the scalar field. The other internal degrees of freedom, spin degrees of freedom are contained in, say, Grassmann variables where you, that you locate inside of the points on the curve. So this is just to say that there's no restriction on the kind of fields you use. And I'm considering scalar field because now you're considering gravity and it's the space-time degree of freedom that matters. Okay, the third step is straightforward putting this thing on a lattice. And if you have time, you can just look into the details of this in the paper, but straightforward. Just assign these things to the lattice. And then we are basically finished with the five choices. On the next slide, I will show a summary tool that gives you the main result, putting everything together. But now let's summarize the five choices. Focus on gravitational degree of freedom, which shows path integral. And then indefinite causal structure come in already at this step. Then we introduce the world function as our basic variable. This also motivates us to use a skeleton for the relational and local variable. But next, we used Packer's trick to express the gravitational amplitude in terms of sigma. And this is what makes this approach different from the other approaches. There are other approaches that use invariant distances, for example, Regi calculus. But the use of Parker's trick distinguishes this approach. And finally, we use the world line formalism to incorporate matter. So why do I make this distinct choice of Parker's magic and world function? It's because of these motivations I presented. So sigma is a simple quantity. It conveniently incorporates matter degrees of freedom, and it makes the causal structure manifest. And these are useful in dealing with some difficulties when you want to get deep into quantum gravity. And this is the main result. On the right, this is the world quantum gravity picture. It can be motivated by matter QFT. So this is your standard Feynman diagram for just matter. If you transit into quantum gravity using this approach, you will have additional edges. These dashed edges, they express quantum gravitational degrees of freedom. And they have an expression like this. And your matter degrees of freedom, your Feynman propagator, is broken apart into smaller pieces, expressed in terms of this. And in the end, you have this additional sum over different gravitational configurations as part of your path integral
for gravity.
Finally, I want to address this question. Why do we single out the causal structure for studying quantum gravity? You remember this ice cream question. If most approaches quantum gravity approaches generically incorporate indefinite causal structure, what's the point of singling it out? My answer is that this is just a vague idea. There could be an upper bound in causal uncertainty. So imagine you mix different causal structures. What's the largest uncertainty you have? It's different causal structures are roughly equal in terms of weights. And this means that there's a potential fixed point under a change of scale. Imagine a large scale uncertainty in causal structure is small. As you go to smaller scales, the uncertainty grows. But they can't grow without a limit because you're dealing with just limited number of causal structures. And you will reach a fixed point. And this has potential insights into the UV structure of both matter and quantum gravity. With that, thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
So it's an interesting approach, but one thing I wonder is the matter part. How will this incorporate fermions, where you need to have a tetrad and couple that way? A and B, fermions don't like being put on lattices, though there's some progress. Have you thought about that at all?
Yes. First of all, I think I've seen arguments that, you know, if you couple to fermion, you have to use tetrads. But I've also seen papers that say you don't have to. You can introduce some space-time dependent choices of the Dirac matrices that allows you to get rid of, that allows you to avoid using tetrads. So I think tetrad is not necessarily a problem. Even though you don't introduce tetrads anywhere, it's still possible to couple to fermion, although this is something that needs to be looked at.
I think you actually need to do it.
Yes.
Okay.
The second question is about lattice. About the fermion on lattice, there are some terrible anomalies, etc. may arise, or fermion doublings, etc. I'm not sure about the status in the world line approach, because in standard lattice theories, we discretize the theory. But here on the world line approach, we're still having integrals on the world line. And it could be just that there's no problem. But again, this is something that needs to be looked into.
We have time for one more question. It's Fabio.
So you're calculating transition amplitudes. So we understand this as you have a cat and a bra and you're calculating the transition amplitude, right? So usually we require a transition amplitude to be normalized, such that when you take the modulo square and you sum, say, over all the bras, you get one, or if you sum over all the cats. And these works usually require an interpretation that in some sense the bra is in the past, the cat is in the past, and the bra in the future, or in a way you have one is the preparation and the other is the measurement. So it's symmetric between the two, but definitely one has to be the preparation and one has to be the measurement. Now you say that in your approach, your amplitudes mix up all possible ways in which x and y could be time-like and space-like. The question is, do you still have normalization, or how is normalization of these integrals defined?
The short answer is that this is close to Baker's boundary approach. So several comments to expand on that. First of all, I'm not introducing a Hilbert space anywhere.
Second of all,
I'm considering relative probabilities. You compare the relative. You can always renormalize.
We don't care about normalization.
Third comment is that unitarity is something we want to consider, people want to consider. And this is basically, you're asking this question about if you use a path integral approach to quantum gravity, how do you consider normalization?
Yeah.
And I believe maybe John will talk about this. There are graphical ways to consider unitarity, cutting rules, etc. Just basically, if you don't start with a canonical quantization approach, how do you consider unitarity? I'm saying there's some ways to consider that. And in terms of normalization, just relative probabilities.
So the previous session is finished. There's lunch. the tolerance for discussions. So that's it.